Well, here we are, October. We're into the last quarter of the year. 1st of October, Tuesday. I'm Alec Hogg from Biz News. Tonight's Biz News briefing, we're going to hear from Magnus Haystick, independent financial advisor, about the BHI Ponzi scheme's facilitator, one Haldane, who has been barred for 30 years. Why hasn't he gone to jail? And then we've got a rising star on the political analysis front. Makhoni Maja will be giving us her insights into the ructions at Tshwane. There's a terrific piece from our partners at the Financial Times of London, and another piece from our partners at The Economist. The FT's one is about how Chinese companies are starting to crunch the competitors in Southeast Asia. And watch out, world, if you happen to be competing against them in any degree. Big messages there for South African businesses. And as far as The Economist is concerned, there's a wonderful story about luxury gyms. Gyms have made a huge, huge comeback. And now the better-heeled people are wanting greater luxury. It's a terrific story right at the end of today's program. In between all of that, I spoke earlier today to Gerry Fourie, the chief executive of Capitec. Believe this, the increase in the share price today after a 36% jump in the profits is enough to have created a mini Capitec of not that many years ago. 14 billion added to market cap. Well, quite a show coming up for you in the next half hour. But let's kick off with the BHI Ponzi story. Biz News has been on top of this. My colleague Chris Staines done a lot of work. Asime Nyede, one of our reporters, has also been on it, finding out what's going on with this BHI company. The fellow behind it is in jail. He gave himself up, said that he'd created a Ponzi scheme, and they locked him away. But one of the biggest facilitators is a gentleman by the name of Haldane, and he and one of his colleagues have now been barred for 30 years. The big question, of course, is when is he going to join his counterpart in jail? One doesn't know about that yet. It's a long, long way to go still in all of this, but thousands of people have been conned out of lots and lots of money. Let's find out what Magnus Haystick thinks about the whole story.
Well, it looks like the FSCI has thrown the book at the guys that was involved in the BHI Trust. I mean, to debar someone for 30 years is effectively what, you know, it's a life sentence. So in effect, they'll never work in the industry again. And I think it reveals that the BHI Trust and the individuals involved in that, they were very naughty guys. They've been stealing and siphoning money for many, many years. And I'm just surprised that it took so long for the scheme to be exposed. As I said on an earlier interview with Alec, we picked this up many years ago. We looked at it and we walked away and we said, not interested. And we actually removed clients out of it. But you know what I think, though, and I often think, you know, trying to analyze why people fall for these scams. And apart from the high returns that they offered, but the returns were not that high relative to what you could have got in the market. But I think they were whispering into the ears of their clients that this is tax-free money. We don't report to SARS. And I think that's where they hooked the investors to come and put money. And people would, you know, look at you and say, well, we don't pay tax on those investors because it's a trust and the usual spin story. So I think the tax angle was one of the reasons why people stood in a queue to hand over their money to these players. Now, the BHI Trust was run by Craig Warriner. He's in jail at the moment. And then Michael Haldane and Mauro Fallon were very prominent financial advisors, very They were appearing on all media all the time in various outlets, advertising, very aggressive advertising, and they had a big business. But behind the scenes, we know that they were naughty guys, and the FECI rightly stepped up and slapped them with a big fine, and of course, there's still criminal proceedings on its way.
Well, Magnus, sorry, continue.
What's interesting is that the FECI has also been very, very active the last past year. I mean, they've debarred 156 people from the industry, which is a record high. Apart from these three players that we've just mentioned, we also know about Marcus Joester, who was fined 475 million rand and the day before he shot himself. But there's another player that's popped up. His name is Koenraad Botha. And I had to search for him, but he was slapped with a fine of 216 million rand. And below the radar, he was also running a very, very dicey Ponzi scheme, attracting people, gullible people with very high interest rates. But they also closed him down quite rightly. And so, yeah, they've been very, very busy.
Magnus Haystack is the chief investment officer of the company he founded, Brenthurst Wealth. And Craig Wariner, who he referred to, got a lot of his money from people at St. Stithians. He was an active member of the Old Boys Association at St. Stithians. He pulled in a lot of the teachers, the parents of pupils, others, other old boys. And St. Stithians, well, I guess if you can get yourself into one of those networks and give them the kind of money that Wariner was donating, you can keep the Ponzi scheme going for quite a bit longer. What is a Ponzi scheme? Well, it's where those who have invested get paid the proceeds by those new investors coming in. So it only lasts for as long as the money, as for as long as you get fresh rabbits coming in, if you like. So the fresh money comes in, that gets used to pay those who've been in longer, but eventually it all collapses. And in this case, Craig Wariner literally walked into the police station and said, throw away the key, I'm guilty. And that's what's happened. He's still in jail, hasn't been able to get out. But this Michael Haldane and his partner, Mauro Forlan, were really riding high at one point in time. When the whole thing broke and we reported on it and on their involvement, their company's name is Local and Global. If you have driven anywhere near Mill Park in Johannesburg, you would have seen the old metal box head office had branding around it for Local and Global. They had pretty much the whole building. Just before the thing collapsed, they hosted none other than Alan Gray's investment managers to try and buy themselves some credibility. But it didn't take terribly long. We got a lot of lawyers' letters. That's what happens with these crooks. But eventually, justice has prevailed. On a different note, we've been following lots of interesting stuff happening in the political front. Today, I had a chat with Makoni Maja. She is the campaign manager at the Institute for Race Relations and one of the up-and-coming political analysts. Let's have a listen in.
Those messages are not being communicated to South Africans in a way that makes it relevant to their day-to-day lives. And so I think we, in the specifically in the media space, in the political analysis space, need to make a case for why the GNU has strengthened the rand and why that's been in the best interests of South Africans. And one of those ways is fuel prices, right? Fuel influences the prices of goods across the board. Delivery of goods does not take place without fuel, and delivery can drive up the cost of goods and services. It needs to be demonstrated to them that if fuel prices are cheaper, then they're able to get more value for their rand. Their rand goes a far longer way than it today than it did even months before the GNU. And so I think it's really up to us in the media class to speak to South Africans in a way that they understand, in the way that they can connect to those messages with things that are immediate to them.
Not just to the public generally, but even to people in Parliament, because we hear again, to quote Muzi, he says, the people in the executive, they get the GNU, they love it. But not everybody in the ANC who's sitting in parliament actually agrees. They're not really seeing this as being of much benefit to them and elsewhere throughout the organization. So I suppose communication is very important.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is also due to the effect that GNU will have on people whose interests are not necessarily in the best interests of South Africans ultimately, right? Because we've seen how these non-ANC GNU ministers have been able to come in and expose a lot of corruption that was previously concealed and that we would have never known of and would have never been dealt with. And so a lot of those non-ANC GNU ministers have brought sunlight and exposed a lot of the corruption that has been happening within government. And obviously that has exposed a few of those people within parliament who I don't think in good faith show a lack of understanding in some of those scenarios you've painted out about bonds and markets and the RAND, certainly. It may be a bit more nefarious than we're giving credit. I think it's just that their interests, which were self-serving, are now being thwarted by good governance, by accountability, and certainly by rule of law, seeing the law being applied equitably across the board and having people being held accountable for their actions, which they previously were not.
At a provincial and perhaps, dare we say, at metro level in Gauteng as well?
Yeah, that one is a very difficult case because we've been changing mayors so frequently, it's hard to keep anyone accountable. But I think we will have to wait and see what happens in Tshwane there, because there's also the chance that Celia could be reinstated, though I think very, very slow. But even there, I think you're seeing a lot of incoming mayors, from non-ANC mayors, having to deal with a lot of the previous administration's corruption. So even that has been a problem for the ANC, allowing people outside of the party to come and investigate and expose corruption that was previously hidden from the public because of party lines being towed.
Straight shooter indeed, Makoni Maja. And we were talking about the success to date of the Government of National Unity and how there's a need for South Africans to also appreciate what the international community has. The RAND, a little bit weaker today, sitting at 17 RAND and 25, but that's a long way from the 19 RAND 25 it was at before the formation of the Government of National Unity. And she very rightly points out that if South Africans can kind of get it, that another decline in the petrol price, this time this month of 114 cents a litre, 1 rand 14 cents a litre, is directly related to the strength of the rand, which is directly related to the Government of National Unity, then the man and woman in the street will start understanding why this GNU is so beneficial for the country. Of course, can it be brought down to a local level, provincial to begin with, and then to the local area, as we've seen lots of ructions going on in Tshwane? The latest news there is that the ANC and the Democratic Alliance at a national level are talking about how to bring the local ANC to heel. Where that leaves Herman Mashaba is anybody's guess, but probably not in a position that he thought he would be in. Action SA breaking up the coalition in Tshwane on the promise, or understanding at least, that it would get the mayoral position when the new coalition came in. Be careful what you wish for. It doesn't always work out in the way that you think, especially when it comes to politics. Our next story comes from our partners at the Financial Times in London, and this is focusing on South Korea, but actually has got a heck of a story for South Africa. I can just give you some feedback from a good friend of mine who's very deeply involved in the motor industry. And he says that the Chinese, I asked him about the Chinese vehicles, and he was very senior at one of the major motor manufacturers in the United States. And he says that the advances that the Chinese have made in their motor vehicles makes what they are producing nowadays top quality, top class, and competitive with anything else in the world. And it's not just motor vehicles, as we'll hear in a moment from our partners at the Financial Times of London.
So what we've seen in recent years is Western governments, but particularly the United States, realizing that they do not want to depend on Chinese companies for certain critical technologies, particularly semiconductors, but also batteries for electric vehicles. And these are two difficult to produce technologies that the Koreans both specialize in. And so when the market is restricted or even cut off for Chinese companies, there are actually very few alternatives. And the Koreans are among the very few alternatives to Chinese companies. And that gives the Korean companies a great advantage. And we've seen that when we look at South Korea's overall exports, which have gone up for every consecutive month since October last year.
Okay, so South Korean exports of things like EV batteries have increased since these trade wars started. And that sounds good. So what's the problem?
The problem is that that masks a lot of pain in other sectors where Korean companies are actually struggling to compete with low-cost Chinese alternatives. And these really range from more high-tech sectors like smartphones and for televisions, all the way down to heavy industrial products like steel and petrochemicals.
And just how worried are officials in South Korea about this competition? I mean, what could it ultimately mean for the economy there?
South Korean policymakers are very, very worried about this because in the past, South Korea could never compete with Chinese companies on quantity, but would have an edge on quality. They had more sophisticated technologies, more advanced production techniques. But in almost every area now, Chinese companies have either caught up with or surpassed the Korean companies. And so the only thing they have left really is Western trade barriers and restrictions protecting their products in Western markets. But of course, Western markets is not the same thing as global markets. And so when you're looking at the global competition, Korean companies are really set to suffer unless they can improve their own innovation.
Yeah, and I'm curious also, what kind of broader lessons do you think can be learned from South Korea's experience?
South Korean companies are very acutely aware of what's happening in the Chinese market. And actually, they were much quicker than many Western companies in realizing that the rise of domestic Chinese rivals in the Chinese market would mean that foreign companies would have to move away from China, not just in terms of production, but also in terms of relying on the Chinese market for consumers. What's happening now, however, is it's one thing to lose in the Chinese market. It's another thing to lose to Chinese companies in the other markets that you have identified as alternatives to China. And so what it suggests is that for a lot of companies in a lot of countries, there's really not going to be anywhere to hide from Chinese competition in certain sectors.
I think just pause a little on that last one. For a lot of companies in a lot of countries, there's really going to be nowhere to hide from Chinese competition. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Anyway, let's move on to a company that is able to compete against anybody in the world, and that's Capitec. Capitec has continued to go from strength to strength. Interim results were released today. That's for the 6 months to the end of August. I had a conversation with the chief executive, Harry Faree. It's on or will be on BizNews TV after the BizNews briefing has been released. Remember, we wait until to give you the first bite on the briefing, and then you can go and watch the full interview. But it's well worth doing so, even if you aren't a Capitec client or a Capitec shareholder. And by the way, if you're between the ages of 20 and 60, there's a 50% chance that you are a Capitec client. That's how big the market share is now in South Africa. The company has also moved into the international environment. It's got 22 million clients. And I ask Harry Faree, what's your secret? What is the Capitec secret coming from nowhere to be such a dominant player? Here's his answer.
I think the word is ecosystem, Alec, because what we all want to do is, if you look at our business banking clients, I said it this morning that a business bank person is looking for two things. He's looking for affordable transaction platform. He's looking for credit, and he's looking for clients. He wants to grow his business. And if you look at, we've got 23 million clients. So we can, in your business, we can identify all the clients in Hermanus or close to Hermanus, and we can actually connect and create the ecosystem between your business and their business. And that gives you power. And then it's a credit risk assessment. So how do you create that ecosystem between our 23 million clients and then with our business banking, especially your small businesses? How do you create that? You create a Capitec ecosystem. And then how do you make certain that we support that with our insurance business? So if I look at especially insurance and business banking, we believe there's plenty of runway. And if I look at the retail space, you know, optimizing that 23 million clients, we're sitting out of that 23 million clients, 8.5 million is actually banking with ourselves. So they've got their salaries on deposit with us. So we believe there's a lot of runway. And if you look at value-added services, if you told me 20 years ago or 10 years ago, we would be selling DStv streaming through our platform, I would have said to you, you're crazy. Now, today, it's a value-added service that we provide for clients because client wants to do streaming. So we're all continuously looking in the value-added space. How do we create value for our clients? Because clients is looking not purely at banking, but they're looking at financial services and that you bring the best type of offers through to your client base. So we believe there's plenty of opportunity.
So putting the client at the center of your universe, a little bit like what your partners at Amazon do. Huh? How much has that partnership paid off for you? I see on the digitization, you're now moving even more aggressively. They even cracked a logo on your presentation today.
Yeah, well, if you look at Amazon AWS, we've got everything in the cloud with themselves, and that gives us, it's incredible, your efficiency and your decision-making, where you're 80% quicker and faster and more efficient. We used to run provision models. It took 4 or 5 days. Now we do it in an hour. And I'm talking 2 years ago. So their capabilities is immense. Connect, the fact that you've got AWS Connect or Amazon Connect, it's our telephone system that links into the cloud, that goes into Salesforce. So every single time that you talk to ourselves in our call centers, it goes into the client history, so that we can track and understand what happened to you, yourself, and the agent. So Amazon is a critical part of our business, and we've copied a little bit of what they've done. We worked quite a lot with them, and their team size pizzas, where they say a team should be able to eat one pizza and that should feed them. That's the type of concepts that we've stolen from them or learned from them. But yeah, we've got a very good relationship.
Artificial intelligence?
Well, that's where Microsoft is coming in. So it's big. It's part of AI is the future. We've actually got a project currently running whereby in our branches, because you can assume now with our consultants, Sunny, they don't have 3-4 products, but they've got 20 plus. And for them to remember everything and understand everything, AI is perfect, because if they got stuck, you can just press a button and get the latest questions out. So we're using in recruitment, going through job descriptions. So AI with Microsoft is a critical part of our future.
So interesting there. Partnering with a market leader globally on the cloud, that's Amazon Web Services, and with Microsoft, the global leader in artificial intelligence through the connections there with ChatGPT on AI. Capitec's quite an extraordinary organization. They also have just bumped up their 40% shareholding in an East European bank to 100%. So now looking at Spain, Mexico, Czech Republic, other developing markets. It's like the Capitec story has still got a long, long way to go. Just to bring you up to date on what's happened on the markets today, it's been a, Well, mixed, but a green day generally. The all-share index about 1% up. Capitec, at one stage, the share price was more than 4% higher. It tempered down a little, as I guess there was some profit-taking from traders, but it's still looking at about just over 2% better on the day as a whole. And as I mentioned, at one point, they'd added $14 billion to market cap on the move in the share price today. Other major moves on the market, yesterday it was the platinum shares that came under pressure. Today it was the platinum shares that went up. But a stock that I've been watching quite closely over the past week or so is OUTsurance. It continues to gain ground. It's again at a new high today. I'm not sure, we'd need much smarter people than me to tell you whether or not the run is over and the stock is overpriced, but it's almost like the innovative companies are getting rewarded now by South African shareholders, Capitec being one, OUTsurance being another. Talking of innovation, the gym scene has really needed innovation in most recent times, and our partners at The Economist ran a terrific story on this. It is on the BizNews website, and what The Economist does is that instead of using AI to read the story, they bring in actors to a studio at the Economist building in London and read it to us. So let's sit back and listen to the Economist story on luxury gyms.
In May, Equinox, a luxury gym, launched a membership that costs $40,000 per year, half the median household income in America, where the chain is based. The plan includes blood tests, a sleep coach and a nutritionist, as well as access to the group's swanky clubs. Julia Klim of Equinox explains why people pay. You can buy a Chanel bag every year, but health and looking well is the ultimate luxury symbol. Analysts proclaimed the death of the gym during the COVID-19 pandemic, when fitness centres shut and people got used to online workouts with a towel in place of a yoga mat and a couple of bottles of Pinot Noir for weights. Customers signed up for at-home alternatives such as Peloton, a maker of high-tech exercise bikes, which hit a value of almost $50 billion in January 2021. But since March 2021, footfall at gyms across America has been growing, according to Placer AI, a location analytics firm. The global market for physical activity, including everything from apparel to equipment, will grow by 8% a year in 2023-27, forecasts the Global Wellness Institute, a non-profit group. Peloton's value has fallen by 96%. As Fritz Landmann, head of ClassPass, an exercise subscription firm, puts it, there's nothing that replicates that in-person experience yet. Industry watchers have spotted a barbell effect, where mid-range gyms are losing out. PwC, a consultancy, says the budget segment has doubled its share of Britain's fitness industry in the past decade to almost a fifth of the private market. Will Orr, head of the Gym Group, a low-cost chain, compares gyms to airlines. People buy into that no-frills proposition, he says. The rich still want frills, however, so luxury gyms are also thriving. The pandemic got wealthy folk worrying about their health. Wearable devices now tell them how well they sleep or respond to sugar, creating new nudges to work out. In a survey by MindBody, which makes fitness software, in 2021 most Americans said they exercised to control weight. In 2023, most said it was to live a long, healthy life. The buzzword in the industry is wellness. Third Space, a high-end gym group in London, is installing cold plunges, cryotherapy chambers, and red light therapy rooms. 5 years ago, if you asked somebody why they use the sauna, they would have said, "It feels quite nice," says its boss Colin Waggett. Now they talk about recovery, sleep, and mental well-being. Gyms now face a test. A new generation of slimming drugs such as semaglutide are selling fast. Bloomberg, a data provider, reckons worldwide sales will reach $94 billion in 2030. Why sweat away in the gym? Mr. Waggett argues that slimming drugs can cause users to lose muscle as well as fat. Shedding weight also inspires people to tone up, he believes. It gives them a catalyst for change, he says. there is another reason to hit the gym. As youngsters battle loneliness, gyms are hosting socials. At Equinox, Friday evenings are a new peak time. The gym is the new happy hour, the new dating place, the new connector, says Ms. Klim. Would a $40,000 membership be worth it if you left the gym fitter, calmer, and with a date?
$40,000 membership? Don't convert that into rand. Well, the US market's a little bit softer today as at the opening, and the Chinese market's had another good run. It seems as though that's the hot place to put your money. But if you're South African, don't worry too much, because chances are pretty good that in your portfolio, your asset manager's got Prosus or Naspers, and they are totally exposed to the Chinese market through their shareholding in Tencent. Well, that's it for today. I'll be back again with you, same time, same place tomorrow. Until then, cheerio.